Good morning. This is Howell Jackson again, and welcome to Lecture 5 of our Introduction to Financial Institutions Lecture Series. Let me begin this morning's lecture by apologizing to the class that the last lecture, Lecture 4, was posted late in the day on October 1st. I had some technical difficulties with the production of the lecture and wasn't able to get it onto the servers until the end of the day. And I'm sorry if this inconvenienced members of the class. I gather some of you were looking for the lecture on the 1st and couldn't find it then. Fortunately, however, one of the advantages of this approach to lecturing is that you can watch the lectures whenever you want, and I'll understand if some of you haven't been able to get to Lecture 5 until later in the week of April 5th. Let me also say by way of introduction that two very good comments were posted on the discussion groups over the past week or so, one by Guo Li regarding the alternative strategies exercise, and another one by Chen Wei Hung about antitrust concerns. What I've done is responded to both of these comments on the discussion groups. And I would just invite all the members of the class that are interested to take a look at both the questions, which I thought were quite interesting, and you can also have a look at my replies. I'm delighted for members of the lecture series to post whatever kind of comments they want after the classes, raising questions or pushing me further in various parts of the analysis. And I will do my best to answer them on a weekly basis. It will also help me to structure future lectures if I have a better sense of what it is that you all are interested in. So this is exactly what I was hoping would happen with the discussion groups, and I will continue to post them. One other introductory matter for this week. There is a note prepared by my research assistant, Ren Yunan, on the webpage for Lecture 4. It squibs two cases, one case, the Cachada case, which we discussed last week, but it also has some information about the Windstar case, which we'll be discussing today. So I would encourage those of you who are interested in getting the note to download it. And it will give you some additional background about the two cases. Our primary task in today's class is to discuss and complete our analysis of capital requirements for depository institutions. In the last class, we discussed the enforcement of these capital requirements in the Cachada case, and also had a look at a simple problem of bank capital. This morning, what I'd like to do is begin our discussion with a slightly more complex capital requirement problem, that is problem 321, and then I'd like to turn to the Windstar case and at the end of the hour get into a discussion of prompt corrective action and have some general analysis of capital requirements and their potential and potential problems. So that's the structure of today's class, and now let's turn to problem 321. As you will recall from the last lecture, we were discussing briefly problem 321 at the close of the hour, and I had converted the balance sheet, which is referred to in this problem, into the structure that we have been using in a number of different problems in this course. The assets on the left-hand side, which I have included here in much greater detail than usual, and then the liabilities on the right. Now, as you'll see in this exercise, the institution has roughly $4 billion worth of assets. In order to figure out its compliance with the risk-based capital requirements, however, it is necessary to convert those assets into risk-weighted measurements. On this next slide, I've indicated an approximation of how the assets on this balance sheet would be weighted. The cash and due from banks item would have a 20% weighting, most likely, for the risks associated with collection transactions from other banks. The other large item, loans, has a 100% weighting as the category that is applied to most commercial and consumer lending transactions. Lease financing, which is similar to commercial lending, also has a 100% risk weighting. The other smaller categories range from U.S. and agency securities, which are principally paper of the United States government, which has a zero rating, to state securities, which are given a 20% rating, and federal funds sold, also a 20% rating, and also money market securities, which have a 20% rating. So the theory here is that these categories of securities, except for government securities, have some amount of risk, but not quite as much risk as commercial loans, which have the 100% weighting. If you do the calculations, it's possible to adjust the $4 billion of assets of this institution into a risk-weighted asset measure. On this next slide, I have performed such a calculation, and you can see that the risk-weighted assets of the institution on its balance sheet are roughly $2.2 billion, slightly more than half of the actual assets of the institution. The risk-weighted assets calculated in this way are often less than the total assets because a number of the assets held by the institution have zero weightings or some fractional weighting, whereas only some of the assets have the 100% weighting given commercial loans and leases. So as a first cut, the institution has $2.2 billion of risk-weighted assets. But is this a complete measurement of risk-weighted assets? Well, if you read the introductory materials of the casebook carefully, the answer to this question is no. There are also so-called off-balance sheet items that must be taken into account into calculating the risk-weighted assets of the institution. So there are two ways in which risk weightings improve upon traditional leverage requirements. One way is that they distinguish between the different types of assets that are held on an institution's balance sheet in determining how much capital the institution is required to hold. But they also take into account certain things that were never included in traditional bank capital requirements. And these are the so-called off-balance sheet items, transactions or contracts into which the institutions have entered, which do not appear directly on the balance sheet, but which expose the institutions to a certain amount of risk. One example, illustrated in this case, are letters of credit issued by the bank in support of various other borrowers. Also, commitments to make loans in the future are a form of off-balance sheet transaction. On the slide, I have shown the approximate risk adjustments these items would make. In creating its total risk-weighted asset measurement, a bank would have to take these additional items into account. And so for this institution, in problem 321, the total risk-weighted assets would be closer to $2.4 trillion if off-balance sheet items were also taken into account. So to calculate the risk-weighted assets, you need to figure in both on-balance sheet and off-balance sheet items. And then it is necessary to use this measurement to figure out the risk-based capital requirements for the institution. As I mentioned earlier, there are two risk-based capital requirements. There's a 4% risk-weighted requirement that has to be supplied with Tier 1 capital, and then an 8% requirement for total capital. Using the measurements that I have on the slides here, that would mean the institution in problem 321 needs to have more than $95.9 million of Tier 1 capital and more than $91.7 million of total capital. Let's see if the institution meets these requirements. Take a look over at the definition of Tier 1 capital, which we discussed in the last class. One of the most common sorts of Tier 1 capital is shareholders' equity. And if one looks at the balance sheet of this institution, it has $169 million worth of equity. which is more than adequate to meet the requirements of Tier 1 capital for the risk-based capital measurements. What about total capital? Well, as we discussed last week, total capital requires the inclusion of both Tier 1 capital and so-called Tier 2 capital. That's also defined in the regulations to include a number of items, including loan loss reserves and various kinds of alternative types of capital, and in particular, subordinated debt. In the case of Problem 321, both subordinated debt and loan loss reserves are present on the liability side of the balance sheet, and while a modest reduction in loan loss reserves is required to meet the rule that they not exceed 1.25% of risk-weighted assets, even with that adjustment, there is more than enough Tier 2 capital to bring the institution comfortably above the requirements which we previously discussed, and in particular the requirement that it has $191.7 million worth of total capital or more in order to be in compliance with these requirements. So this institution, in this exercise, is fully in compliance with the risk-based capital requirements. And what I'd like to do now is to speak for a moment about whether or not these risk-based capital requirements constitute a valuable improvement on the more traditional leverage requirements that were in place in the United States before 1989. One could spend an entire lecture, or really even an entire lecture series, discussing the pros and cons of the new risk-based capital requirements. And it's a subject that has received considerable attention in the United States over the past 10 years. But let me just make some brief comments at this point of the pros and cons of this approach to bank regulation. At the outset, I think you have to acknowledge that this approach has many advantages over simple leverage rules. And on balance, it's a positive development in many respects. Clearly, there are distinctions in the risks associated with different assets, and the risk-based capital rules try to account for those differences in their measurement of risk-weighted assets. Also, as I mentioned earlier, the inclusion of off-balance sheet items is clearly an improvement over earlier capital requirements, which did not acknowledge the importance of these relationships. I think particularly in the past 15 years, with the emergence of interest rate swaps and foreign exchange swaps and various other kinds of derivative contracts, this activity is increasingly important to the business of depository institutions and is appropriately accounted for in basic capital requirements. Another important advantage of the risk-based capital rules is that they have established an international standard for banking regulation. The Basel Committee in Switzerland has initially developed these risk-based capital rules, and they've been adopted in the leading countries of the world as a basic measurement for bank supervision, and have served as guidelines for a number of other countries. So I think it's quite viable to have the creation of these standards to which all of the nations of the world can aspire in regulating their own banking institutions. On the less positive side, there have been a variety of problems of implementation of risk-based capital rules. I think one of the most significant problems has to do with the basic risk weightings themselves. Those of you who tried to work out problem 321 probably were puzzled as to how particular assets should actually be classified. And I think most observers would agree that there is a certain degree of arbitrariness in deciding the particular weightings of individual assets. There's not a scientific method for risk weightings. It's just a rough approximation of their basic risk characteristics, and these approximations may not always be accurate. Certainly, within asset categories, there is a considerable degree of variation in risk. For example, within the loan category, there's a wide degree of variation between the most risky loans a banking institution might make and the least risky, yet they're all assigned a 100% weighting under the risk-based capital rules. Equally importantly, the rules are relatively mechanical in their application. They don't take into account the fact that some assets may have certain relationships. Some assets may do well when others do poorly, and in that sense, their risks may cancel out each other, or possibly they could exacerbate each other's risks. The risk-based capital rules tend to look at each asset on its own without any consideration of its relationship to other assets on the balance sheet, and also relatively little account to relationship with the liabilities of the depository institution. The extent to which an institution is well matched between its assets and liabilities was not taken into account in the early versions of risk-based capital requirements, although some efforts to improve this shortcoming have been undertaken in the past few years. Another area of concern in the risk-based capital rules is the extreme complexity of their application to off-balance sheet transactions, and in particular, various kinds of swaps. The casebook only alludes to this difficulty in passing because it really is quite complex. But suffice it to say that once you get into the actual rules in this area, they are inordinately complicated, and it is not entirely clear that they work correctly in all contexts at this point, although the Basel Committee continues to work to refine the requirements. On this point, I would say in passing, if any of you are particularly interested in the current state of risk-based capital rules, the website of the Basel Committee in Switzerland, the Bank of International Settlements, has quite a few interesting documents dealing with this subject, and there is a link to that site on my webpage at Harvard University, and if you want to take a look at it, I think you will find the documents to be quite informative. But I think you will also agree, if you take a look at these materials, that there is incredible complexity in the actual implementation of the risk-based capital rules. So, in short, my assessment would be the risk-based capital requirements are an important improvement over simple leverage rules. However, they are not a complete panacea for bank regulation. They have a number of shortcomings. There is a number of areas of bank risks that the capital rules can't take account of completely, and so they're not a substitute for other forms of supervision. And at least in the United States, they're seen as an important component, but hardly a complete system of regulatory supervision for our depository institutions. One other area of capital requirements that I'd just like to mention in passing, it's dealt with briefly in our casebook at page 207, is the issue of mark-to-market versus historic value accounting. The balance sheets that we've been looking at so far have been based on historic value accounting. So loans are held on the balance sheet based on their initial value, unless intervening events make it necessary to mark them down in some way. Marketable securities, on the other hand, tend to be marked to market on a regular basis, typically on a daily basis. There has been some discussion in the banking area of trying to move towards a market value accounting system where all of the assets and liabilities of an institution would be adjusted on a periodic basis to reflect their market value. If that were the case, setting capital requirements for depository institutions would be substantially easier because regulatory authorities would always know the actual value of both the institution's assets and its liabilities. And theoretically, one might also be able to mark to market all of the off-balance sheet transactions of the institution as well. Unfortunately, in practice, mark-to-market accounting has been difficult to implement for depository institutions, in part because their primary business is still the making of loans to individual borrowers, and these loans almost always do not have readily ascertainable market values. As a result, the balance sheets reflect historic values for the most part on loan transactions, which constitute an important part of the bank portfolio. In the future, it may be possible to develop new techniques for making adjustments in loan values to make them more closely approximating a market value accounting system. But that is something, at least in the United States, which seems still to be in the future. And our current system of historic value accounting is likely to persist for some time to come. Again, those of you who are interested in the subject, I would point you to the brief discussion on page 207. Later in the course, when we discuss investment companies and securities firms, you will be able to see an example of institutions that rely on market value accounting. But these institutions tend to limit their assets to marketable securities, which in the United States tend to have daily market values through exchanges and other price-setting mechanisms. Now I'd like to turn to our next section of the capital regulation discussion, which concerns the transition to higher capital requirements, and in particular, the Supreme Court decisions in the Windstar case. To introduce this discussion, let me begin by giving you a little bit of background on the thrift crisis which led to the Windstar case. I think you will find this of some interest to current situations in certain Asian financial markets, and it's also important to understand the context of this particular case. The thrift industry, as you may recall, is a section of the depository institution field in the United States. Traditionally, thrift institutions raise their money primarily from retail deposits and re-lent them to consumers in the form of residential mortgages. And over the years, the thrift industry has been a primary supplier of capital to individuals purchasing homes. During the late 1970s and early 1980s, the thrift industry ran into substantial problems. In particular, rising interest rates during the period caused the industry's cost of funds to increase. At the same time, innovations in the mortgage lending business, essentially the introduction of new suppliers into the mortgage business, put competitive pressure on the industry's traditional lines of business. As a result of these two factors, there were substantial losses for many members of the thrift industry, and the industry was widely recognized as being in crisis at the time. As a result, there were several regulatory responses, both by the government and the supervisory agencies. By the government here, I mean the Congress of the United States and also the supervisory agencies. A number of actions were taken. In particular, the thrift's powers were deregulated in the sense that thrift institutions were given the authority to engage in different lines of businesses, with the idea being that these new powers would help them diversify their portfolios and be less dependent on the increasingly difficult mortgage business. In addition to that, however, there were other actions taken by regulatory authorities which became controversial over time. In particular, regulatory authorities began to accept lower capital reserves for thrift institutions in recognition that a number of thrifts were losing money and suffering a decline in their capital basis. There was also a decision on the part of regulatory authorities to postpone the closure of institutions that were either insolvent or close to insolvent. There were a number of reasons for this decision. In part, the government was motivated by the fact that factors beyond the industry's control had led to some of their problems, in particular, the inflation, which caused the high interest rates of the 1970s, was really the cause of governmental policies, and the introduction of new competition in the mortgage business was not the direct responsibility of the thrifts themselves either. So there was a sense in which, since the institutions had not themselves caused their problems, the government should not force them to close immediately, but rather should give them time to grow out of their difficulties. Also motivating the government's action was the fact that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, designed to protect the thrift depositors, referred to as the FISLIC, Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, had inadequate reserves at the time to deal with the crisis. As a result, a number of their policies were designed to prevent losses from being imposed on the FISLIC fund. For a combination of these reasons, a number of institutions were allowed to remain in business even though their capital bases were low. Another action that the government took, and one that was directly related to the Windstar case, was the encouragement of something known as supervisory mergers. These are transactions in which healthy institutions were encouraged to purchase insolvent thrifts. In that way, the industry was somewhat consolidated. There would be fewer institutions trying to make mortgages, and also the institutions that remained would be larger and presumably somewhat better equipped to survive in the future. The problem that regulatory authorities faced with these transactions was finding the cash necessary to encourage the healthy institutions to take over insolvent thrifts. In traditional supervisory mergers, which we will look at a little bit later in this lecture series, the government makes a cash payment to the acquiring institution to cover the losses it can expect to suffer by taking over an insolvent institution. In the case of the thrift crisis, however, the government lacked the cash resources to finance these purchases in the ordinary way. So, as an alternative, they allowed a variety of so-called regulatory forbearances to the acquiring institutions. These are special regulatory authorities which make the transaction more attractive for the acquirer, but don't constitute the payment of cash. There were a number of different regulatory forbearances allowed. One example was the authorization of additional powers for the merged entity. By taking over the insolvent institution, the acquiring institution would get an additional permission to engage in some activity that it would not otherwise be allowed to undertake. Another regulatory forbearance, and the one at issue in the Windstar case, was the allowance of acquiring institutions to use special regulatory accounting rules. In essence, to account for their balance sheet, and in particular for their capital, in ways that were more advantageous than otherwise would have been permitted. In effect, the acquiring institutions were allowed to maintain lower capital than they would otherwise have been after the merger. Let me use a few diagrams now to try to make this transaction a little clearer. In the early 1980s, a number of thrifts, as I mentioned, were close to failure. And they would, of course, have been under fairly close supervision by the regulatory authorities, which at the time was the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. At some point, these thrifts would become, in fact, insolvent, or at least a number of them did. In other words, their liabilities would exceed their assets, and they would have, in essence, negative capital, represented here by the space on the asset side of the balance sheet. Typically, at this point, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board would intervene and appoint a receiver to maintain the institution in operation, but remove its initial management. The next step would be to find some healthy thrift institution that was willing to take over the insolvent thrift. However, because the healthy thrift would be assuming control of an institution with more liabilities than assets, this would be a costly transaction from the healthy thrift's perspective. In return, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board offered certain contractual agreements. These are what I refer to as regulatory forbearances, and they were incentives for the healthy thrift to take over the transaction. They could take the form of cash contributions, but in the early 1980s, they more often took the form of accounting forbearances or other special regulatory approvals. So, in exchange for these incentives, the healthy thrifts would take over one or more insolvent thrift institutions, taking on the liabilities as well as gaining the assets. After the transactions were completed, the institutions had a somewhat unusual balance sheet. It can be characterized in the following way. In addition to typical assets, such as cash reserves and loans, the surviving institution would have a rather large amount of goodwill, referred to in the cases as supervisory goodwill, representing the amount by which the failed thrift's liabilities exceeded its assets at the time of the acquisition. In essence, the institutions were allowed to pretend that this negative value was an asset to be amortized over a certain period of time, often 30 or 40 years. Now, the problem that gave rise to the Windstar case occurred in 1989, after the thrift crisis was well acknowledged and the government intervened aggressively to solve the problem. Amongst other things, in a legislation adopted in 1989, known as FERIA, Congress imposed higher capital requirements on the entire thrift industry. And it also ruled that in the future, no accounting forbearances would be allowed in the computation of capital requirements. In essence, what the Congress did in 1989 was to recognize that the thrift crisis had grown out of control and it was time to shut down insolvent institutions. In the end, as the Windstar case explains, this decision cost the federal government over $150 billion. And the Windstar case is simply one part of the working out of the 1989 legislation. Now, as a statutory matter, I can show you how Congress implemented this particular decision not to allow goodwill to be taken into account in the future. If you think back to our discussion last week and earlier today, there is a definition of Tier 1 capital in the regulatory rules developed after 1989. It includes a definition of what can be considered in regulatory capital, plus a number of deductions. One of the deductions, and the one that's highlighted here, is that all goodwill must be deducted from Tier 1 capital in order to determine compliance with the federal capital requirements. What that rule means is that assets that are dedicated to goodwill must be subtracted from capital. And in this illustration that I've created, you can see that if the capital were reduced by the amount of the goodwill, the vast majority of this particular institution's capital would disappear. And in fact, that's exactly what happened in the Windstar case. Once the regulatory rules of 1989 were put into place, a number of the healthy institutions that had acquired thrifts under the special rules of the regulatory transactions found themselves with inadequate capital under the new regulatory requirements. As an illustration, one of the transactions involved in the Windstar case, not the Windstar institution itself, but an institution known as Statesman, found itself in dramatic noncompliance with capital requirements after the rules were imposed, even though the institution had previously complied with all three capital requirements. So, for example, looking at the bottom of this slide, the institution's risk-based capital requirements had been $7.7 million above the requirements under the old rules, but once regulatory goodwill was deducted, the institution found itself $14.5 million below the regulatory capital requirements. And if you look up at the other measurements of capital, the core capital requirement, which is a leverage requirement, and another tangible capital requirement, which was a specialized requirement for the thrift industry, in all three measurements, the institution lost something like $23 or $24 million worth of capital, which must roughly have equaled the amount of regulatory goodwill it had on its balance sheet at the time the 1989 rules went into place. For institutions in this situation, the 1989 reforms created a substantial problem. All of a sudden, they were substantially out of compliance with regulatory capital rules, and they faced a number of unattractive alternatives. One alternative was to do nothing, in which case they would be shut down and lose all their investment in the thrift institution. That is, the owners would lose whatever residual investment they had in the institution. Another alternative would be to go to the capital markets and try to raise new capital, replacing the $24 million that had been, in essence, lost by the revision of the rules. or they could have done something to their balance sheet, such as shrink in size or sell off assets or redeploy assets in ways that would at least reduce the risk-based capital requirement and to bring themselves into compliance in that way. But what essentially happened with the imposition of these new rules is all of a sudden all of the institutions found themselves in a much less better position than they had anticipated in the 1980s when they engaged in the transactions underlying the case. Now, I think that all of you can probably read the Winstar case and take something out of it for yourself. Let me just say, if you read through the decision, what you'll see is an abbreviated discussion of the background leading up to the supervisory mergers, which I've already discussed, a little more of an explanation of what supervisory goodwill is, and the changes created in 1989 by the Freer legislation. The case then goes on to the legal issue that the Supreme Court was confronted with, and this is really a matter of government contract law in the United States, which is not directly related to financial institutions regulation, although I think some of you may find it of interest to look at. The question that the case is considering is who should bear the cost of the change in law of 1989. It's sort of an interesting question in a number of respects. It's all about the so-called unmistakability doctrine and the question of when an agency, a governmental agency, enters into the kind of supervisory agreements that the Federal Home Loan Bank Board entered into in the 1980s, are those actions binding on Congress? And there were a variety of arguments about this. There was a question about whether Congress could even change the law with respect to these institutions and, in essence, raise their capital requirements by eliminating the special treatment of goodwill. And in prior decisions, the courts concluded that, yes, Congress could change the law if it wanted to, as it did in 1989. However, if it were in a breach of a binding contract, it would be responsible for damages imposed on private parties, that is, the institutions that acquired failed thrifts in the 1980s, and would have to pay damages as a result of a breach of those contracts. So much of the case is about a question of, were these contracts valid contracts? Did the agency have discretion to enter into them? What did the contracts themselves provide? This is essentially a question of who bore the risk of changes in the law. Was it the government or was it the individual parties? And what the Supreme Court concludes in this case is the government did bear the risk under the contracts and they will have to pay damages as a result. So in the United States, this was actually a rather important decision about the responsibility of government for changing capital rules after binding contracts took place. I should note that the government under this theory does not owe any legal obligation to most members of the thrift industry who faced higher capital requirements. The entire industry went from essentially a 3 or 4% capital requirement level up to an 8% capital requirement level in 1989. And this general rise was seen to be well within the authority of the government to change its supervisory structure. It was just those institutions that had specific contracts with the government to use supervisory goodwill in the calculation of their capital that were entitled to the benefit of this decision, and they are proceeding to prosecute the cases against the federal government even now. Now, from an analytical perspective, a legal and analytical perspective, one could say various things about the Winstar case, wondering about the distinction between the government's authority to raise general capital requirements and the limitations of its authority in these particular cases. One might imagine that the government could have accomplished much the same results without breaching its contractual obligations by establishing, for example, different risk weightings for supervisory goodwill as opposed to actually forcing their deduction You might imagine that if they gave them a risk weighting of 200 or 300 or 400%, they would, in essence, have reached much the same result, probably without breaching the contract. But I think that's really more a matter of U.S. Contract law that may not be quite as interesting to foreign observers as they are to domestic lawyers. There's also a very interesting question of the calculation of damages that the government will have to pay in this case, which is the issue that's still being litigated. There's a wide range of estimates of potential damages here, but I think most observers agree that they are in the tens of billions of dollars for the U.S. government. So they're quite a large figure that is involved. But there's a number of questions still to be worked out by the lower courts about the precise measurement of the damages. Anyone who's interested in these issues, I'd be happy to point you to additional writing on this area. But now I think what I'd like to conclude the Windstar case discussion with is some general comments about the implications of the thrift crisis and the Windstar case more generally. The important thing about the Windstar case, I think, that I would like you to take away from this lecture is the cause of the difficulty in the first place. In the 1980s, when the thrift crisis was emerging, there was a general reluctance on the part of the government to address the problems directly. There was essentially a decision that the industry should be given time to work out its problems, and the government should not accept the cost immediately of resolving the crisis in the early 1980s, when it's estimated it would have cost $15 or $20 billion to shut down all the institutions that were becoming insolvent at that time. In retrospect, it's clear that the decision to delay resolution of the thrift crisis dramatically increased its cost to the government. The ultimate price tag for the thrift crisis, as I mentioned, is on the order of $150 billion, which is roughly 10 times what it would have cost, at least estimated what it would have cost in the early 1980s. And this is actually a characteristic phenomenon in financial crises. The desire to push off resolution, to wait for things to work out, often ends up in the crisis becoming greater than it might otherwise have been, particularly in instances where financial intermediaries are allowed to continue in operations with inadequate or even negative capital reserves. The problems that we discussed earlier in this lecture series about moral hazards of low capital levels are directly applicable here. The institutions that have no capital or negative capital have considerable incentives to take substantial risks in order to grow out of their problems. In essence, the owners of the institutions have nothing to lose and everything to gain from high-risk strategies. And high-risk operations is definitely what we observed in the thrift industry in the 1980s in the United States. From my own perspective, I think these lessons are applicable in a variety of other contexts, and I think for the members of this lecture series, one of the interesting questions is their applicability to the Asian financial crisis that's been emerging over the past few years in a number of jurisdictions. In those cases, the problems for the financial institutions tend not to be related to high interest rates, at least as an immediate cause, but rather from non-performing loans. But the result is the same. The effective capital levels of the institutions decline as a result of these loans, whether or not the loans are actually written off. And so you could think of, if you took a country such as South Korea that has depository institutions with non-performing loans, even though the regulatory authorities are allowing them to maintain those loans on their balance sheet at face value, at historic value, the economic value of those loans is substantially less in many cases, which means the actual capital reserves of the depository institutions in countries such as South Korea are really lower than they appear to be. Effectively, the institutions are being allowed to operate with minimal capital reserves, which creates a serious moral hazard problem. Now, potentially in these jurisdictions, the depository institutions will work out their problems and recover as the economies recover, hopefully. However, if the thrift crisis is any guidance, this is a risky strategy for regulatory authorities because it's possible that the institutions will get in much greater difficulty over time, and there are definitely incentives for institutions operating with low capital to have precisely such problems. So I'd be curious if any of you have reactions to the extent that there's comparable issues in the People's Republic of China now. I'd definitely be interested in hearing your comments about that, about those possibilities. But at this point, what I'd like to do is to move on and discuss a little bit more about our final topic, which is the prompt corrective action rules that have evolved in the United States in the 1990s, and in particular in legislation enacted really in response to the thrift crisis again in 1991 that substantially changed the structure of our regulatory structure to make it even more closely tied to the capital measures that we've been discussing today and in last week's lecture. So, turning now to the prompt corrective action provisions, what I suggested for this week's assignment is that you take a look at pages 361 to 63 of the casebook to get an overview of this regulatory structure. And what I'll just do for the balance of this hour's discussion is describe the central features of the prompt corrective action rules. In essence, they are built on a classification system of capital levels. There are five capital categories that are built into the prompt corrective action provisions. You can see these capital rules on in section 1831O of the statutory supplement. The rules you'll see there are rather extensive, but I'll give you the highlights in the lecture here, and then maybe you can work through the details on your own time. What the rules say is that there are essentially two different levels of qualifying capital reserves, institutions that are well capitalized or adequately capitalized, and then there are three descending levels of undercapitalization, ranging from simple undercapitalization to significantly undercapitalized and critically undercapitalized. Rules of thumb here, adequately capitalized is roughly the 8% risk weighted capital reserves. Well capitalized would typically be over 10%. Undercapitalized is anything beneath the 8% requirement. Significantly undercapitalized would be if you miss the requirements by 1% or 2%. Critically undercapitalized, you're typically an institution that has capital of less than 2% of assets. So very substantially undercapitalized, but not technically insolvent. So these are the five basic criteria of capitalization. And then it's interesting to see how the prompt corrective action rules and other regulatory rules make use of these categories. One thing they do is to limit risky activities to those institutions that have adequate capital levels. Now, there are a variety of examples of this in our regulatory structure. One illustration that we haven't looked at so far in the course, but branching rules, certain kinds of branching, establishing new offices, are limited to those institutions that have more than adequate capital levels. Another illustration that we've discussed a little bit already, but let me just put up on the board now. The activities of state chartered banks, generally speaking, state chartered banks cannot engage in activities that national banks can't engage in, but they can get special permission if the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation approves the activity as not imposing substantial risks on the deposit insurance fund. But also the institution must be in compliance with applicable capital standards. So if you're not in compliance with capital standards, there is no chance of getting authority for these new activities, even with FDIC approval. Other kinds of special authority is dependent upon institutions being well capitalized, having more than enough capital to meet the current capital requirements. This under the theory that if the activity has potential risks, if it is potentially a strategy C sort of activity, then it's best for the institution to have more than adequate capital reserves to buffer against any potential losses. So one way in which capital is being used is to make risky activities contingent upon higher levels of capital. However, the really distinctive characteristic of the prompt corrective action rules is their imposition of mandatory supervision for institutions that have inadequate levels of capital. The idea here is directly related to the thrift crisis we were discussing earlier in the hour. The fear is that regulatory authorities might be reluctant to impose stringent supervision on institutions that get into trouble for a variety of reasons, wanting to avoid institutional failures. There may be personal connections between the regulatory authorities and regulated firms. It may just be difficult to be strict in times of economic difficulty. So what the prompt corrective action rules do is to reduce the regulatory discretion to forbear, and also, in the extreme case, to force the closure of institutions that are insolvent or near insolvent. So let me just show you quickly how the prompt corrective action provisions do that. That for every category of undercapitalized institution, there are some mandatory rules imposed on regulators. For example, if you fall just beneath your capital requirements, the regulators have to monitor the institution. They have to demand a capital restoration plan, the kind of plan we saw in the Cuchada case. Asset growth may be restricted for the institution so that it doesn't become any bigger. Special approvals are required for new activities or acquisitions. And there are a variety of other discretionary safeguards, including the right of the banking agencies to downgrade the institution to significantly undercapitalized if they think that additional safeguards are in order. Once an institution is downgraded in this way, or if it simply falls beneath the significantly undercapitalized level, new and more stringent requirements are imposed, and there are specific actions that are authorized to be taken with respect to both the management and the operation of the firm. Finally, if the institution fails to correct its capital levels and it falls to the lowest level of capital rating, which is critically undercapitalized, the regulatory authorities are required, that is, they have no discretion not to shut the institution down within a fixed period of time, in particular 90 days. So the idea here is to avoid the situation that occurred in the thrift crisis, which is to allow institutions, or in particular large numbers of institutions, to continue their operations once they become formally insolvent, or at least critically undercapitalized. And the idea is that if the institutions are shut down at this point, forced to merge or liquidated, whatever the resolution that the institution is put to, the cost to the deposit insurance funds and the federal taxpayers will be substantially reduced. We are fortunate that since 1991, our economy has been in very good shape and the number of bank failures has been very modest. So this provision has not been tested under a severe financial crisis, but at least structurally it's now in place and it's designed to prevent the kinds of problems that led to the Winstar situation in the previous decade. So to conclude now our discussion of capital regulations, let me just make three concluding points. Over the past decade, I think it's clear that reforming capital regulation has been the centerpiece of our revisions of depository institution regulation. Not only have we raised the capital requirements systematically across the depository institution field, but we've imposed a variety of improvements in measuring capital and developing capital requirements, most notably the risk-based capital rules. And we've also tried to tighten our accounting standards to make sure that the capital that is used to meet capital requirements is really there and not just some accounting fantasy. We have also moved considerably forward in integrating capital into the rest of our regulatory structure, making activities approvals contingent upon capital levels when there's any question about the riskiness associated with activities, and also imposing mandatory supervision on firms that fall beneath acceptable levels of capital. For the most part, I think this has been a substantial improvement in our regulatory authority. Having adequate capital reserves is probably the most important way of ensuring prudential operations of financial institutions, and these structures we've put in place have, I think, improved the operations of the industry and the safety and soundness of the industry in the United States substantially. Is the system we have perfect? Well, I think the answer is obviously regulatory systems are never perfect. There are potential concerns with regulatory structure that we've imposed. One concern I think you have to keep in the back of your minds always is there is a risk of imposing too much capital requirements on an industry. It's possible that you could have too many capital requirements that would decrease the efficiency of the industry and impose extra and unnecessary costs on the industry. It's certainly the case that in transitioning to new capital requirements, higher capital requirements, there can be adverse consequences for the economy in transition. And in fact, in the early 1990s, as the higher capital requirements of the post-thrift crisis reforms were imposed, there was a feeling that we had economic consequences. Fortunately, they lasted only a year or two, and once the banks had replenish their capital requirements, the new levels don't seem to be causing any substantial difficulties for our economy. But that's always a potential risk that one would go overboard on capital requirements. I think over the long term, though, the real problems are worrying about whether the measurement system that is in place is adequate or whether there are still potential problems. This is an area that we are continuing to work on in the United States. And the international supervisory community is also working on this issue, and I think it's still a potential problem. And because of the continuing and probably permanent problems of perfect measurement, supervisory oversight, I think, is still an important supplement to capital reserves, particularly when one realizes that the measurement of capital is always dependent upon measuring the value of other parts of the balance sheet, in particular the value of loan portfolios and loan loss reserves. And so supervisory oversight will always be important to police these other areas of institutional activity and is an important supplement or complement to capital requirements. But I think as a general matter, the new systems we've put in place are an improvement and potentially of interest to other regulatory structures being developed elsewhere around the world. Looking forward to next week's lecture. What I'd like to do next week is turn to the lending limit rules that are discussed in Chapter 3, Section 3 of the casebook. If you would take a look at the readings there, beginning on page 141, you can prepare for what we will discuss in that class. Essentially, I'll be working through the lending limit rules and also the rules governing loans to officers, directors, executive officers, and affiliates. It's a complicated system of rules, and I'll try to explain their logic and also why we in the United States, at least, think they're a very important part of our supervisory structure. Now I am ready to conclude Lecture 5 of the Beta lecture series. Again, I welcome any comments or questions on the discussion group for this lecture series. I will try to respond to those comments as I see them, and I will be posting the next lecture, Lecture 6, on April 12th. So I'll look forward to meeting with you again then. Thank you very much.